Gaming and Libraries podcast for August 2009. Hi there, I'm Scott Nicholson, Associate Professor from Syracuse University School of Information Studies. Welcome to the August 2009 Gaming and Libraries podcast. On this month's show, we're first going to hear from Donald Dennis, who talks with Ron Brown from the University of South Carolina about how video games have an impact on real-life situations. We then hear from Beth Galloway, who reviews the book Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. I come back and do a brief review of the board game Tales of the Arabian Nights. M. Brandon Robbins talks about Passage, which is the game of the month over in the Games and Gaming Members Initiative group. And Eli Nyberger comes to talk about the idea of a game jam and focuses on how libraries can encourage people to create games instead of just playing them. And don't forget, this month, just like every month, is Tell a Friend Month. Please let someone know about this podcast. If you enjoy it, post to a mailing list you're on, a discussion list, or to a friend and tell them that you enjoy this podcast and send them over to gamesandlibraries.org. Also, as a reminder, the Gaming Libraries course not only is complete from June, but now I'm adding to it. So if you go to gamesandlibraries.org/course, you can see the 30 videos that I put out to the month of June and the new video for August 2009. It's my intention to do one video a month to continue this course. So with that, let's get on with the show.
Hey, this is Donald Dennis for the Games and Libraries podcast, and I am here with two visitors who were attending our tournament at the Georgetown County Library. So I'm going to turn you over briefly to Ron and then Tom.
Hi, my name is Ron Brown. I'm an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina in Columbia, and I came down here because Donald invited me to speak to the Video Gaming Club about success and about what it means to play video games and how that arc worked in my life.
I'm Thomas. I'm Ron's graduate assistant and one of his students. I'm a born gamer, and this is part of my library science degree.
So here we have one person who's fully entrenched in their profession, and another one who's new, developing into the games and libraries. And both of you, I notice, are wearing your fine video game regalia, a Pac-Man t-shirt, And a digital tie.
An 8-bit tie.
8-bit tie. Yeah, as Ron mentioned, I invited him to come down and talk before the tournament. You know, we have all the kids gathering, getting excited about playing some Super Smash Brothers. He talked to the kids a little bit about what video games, the impact that they've had on his life. So do you want to reveal a little bit about that?
Yeah. As I thought about what to talk about for this video gaming tournament and think about what it is video games mean to me, I talked to a lot of different people. And I asked them, well, what should I do? And I thought about talking about people in popular culture. There's a lot about Obama. There's a lot about Michael Jackson. And I felt like that type of topic wasn't appropriate for the video gaming tournament. So what I decided was that I need to base it on my personal life, and I also need to base it on something that they're interested in. Well, I know that they're playing video games, and so what I stumbled upon was this idea was, wouldn't it be neat if I kind of went back in my past and selected a series of video games, and then when I selected those video games, compare them to lessons that I learned in my life. And so that's how I kind of came up with the topic for the talk.
Well, it was very neat because as you were going through your history of games, I kept thinking, oh, well, for me, here's what I learned from this other game. And so he grabbed some YouTube videos and showed them, and it was very interesting. The kids were kind of chattering at the beginning, and then you first started that first YouTube, and boom, they all started paying attention because you had sound, you had light, you had moving everything, and they got into what you were talking about. You know, I really think that you made that connection. Was there anything you noticed? Oh.
Well, I was just going to talk about the games that I chose and the lessons. Mm-hmm. I think that when I was structuring the talk, what I was trying to also impart on them was how far games have come. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, when we first started gaming, it was on very clunky computers, and you were typing on a keyboard. When the first systems came out, we had very large controllers with one button.
Yep.
And then as the systems got more complex, the graphics improved, the color improved, the plot increased, and the gaming industry just began to flourish. So you have all of these people like the storyboard artist, the writer, and it just the complexity of the games increased. And I think that as I talked about more of the recent game, I think that I saw the excitement. I saw people mentioning games and the games that are being re-released now, like the Street Fighter series and other games that are being released now.
Yeah, and actually I think that did a great job of tying them to their past when a lot of reviewers talk about how bad, oh, we're getting nothing but sequels, we're getting nothing but sequels. But on the other hand, it means that kids today know about the games I was playing 20 years ago because, you know, you've got the Street Fighter 4 or the Mortal Kombat versus DC or the inheritors, direct inheritors from stuff we were playing before. So, yeah, I mean, that was a great history grab, I think.
Yeah. I think from a gaming perspective and from a personal perspective, I kind of like the recycling of the games. And the reason why I like that is because it's easier for me to pick it up and not get beat by a 3-year-old or an 8-year-old.
Yeah, yeah.
So the idea is that, you know, I can, if there's a Mortal Kombat game, I know the mechanics of that, and then I can just try and figure out, well, I know Sub-Zero, I know he throws ice, so let me see if I can figure out how to throw ice in this new game.
Right.
I had six lessons that I wanted to leave with the gamers. The first lesson and the first video game that I focused on was the Dungeons of Daggeroth, and that was a PC game on the TRS-80 computer. And that lesson was be thankful for the opportunities that you were given, because that system, to me, it wasn't a system that I owned. It was one that I checked out from the library. The second lesson was to keep playing and be a good sport. And for me, that system was the Atari system, and the game was Pac-Man. And for me, I was gaming at a very young age, and I wasn't winning a lot of games, and so I learned how to be a good sport and also learned how to play games with my family. The third lesson was to be a team player and to be there for other people. That was during those tumultuous times in puberty and middle school, and there was a lot of me being a loner, and so I learned that, you know, if I want other people to be there for me, then I have to be there for people and be a team player. And that the system was Nintendo and the game was Double Dragon. And then the fourth lesson was strive to be your best. And the system was the Super Nintendo and the game was the Street Fighter 2 or the Street Fighter series. And I was really being very competitive and just trying to be the best player to beat all of my opponents. And not only beat them, but just win with a variety of characters and also excel in my studies. The fifth lesson was to play through any fear that you might have in your life or fear of any obstacles that you have. And the game that embodied that for me was the PlayStation, or the system was the PlayStation, and then the game was Resident Evil. And then the last lesson was don't give up on what you love. And for me, that was in the time where I was pursuing my PhD. And the console that was represented by that was the PlayStation 2 and the Final Fantasy series. So I really come to love that series over time.
So then after we did that, and this is where I made Tom participate in the event, was what do video games mean to you? I had each of the kids talk about what this game room means to them, either through specific video games and tournaments, what they've learned. And they gave us some interesting responses. Was there anything that struck you particularly about that, Tom? Well, was there any way that video games impacted your life or anything you've learned from them?
I would say they impacted me in the same way that a lot of the kids' examples say that they're learning from these games when I came in. And they were talking about they learned how to play with others. They learned to stick with the game and beat it, lessons that Ron just talked about. But also I think games represent and play also overcoming challenges, but not having to overcome challenges. They're unnecessary challenges. And I think that for a lot of these kids, and for when I was a kid playing video games represent a way to develop and challenge yourself and see what you can do in the space of a game without being graded or tested or any harsh penalties. Like, you might be in class, you have to do well on the test, or you'll flunk. Now you have a bad grade, now your parents won't like you, and kids make fun of you. If you're not good at a game, you know, these kids are all friends with each other. There's no impetus to be, you know, if you're not the best, you're not one of us. They're all playing.
Right.
It's entirely for fun, but they're pushing each other in ways that they might not even notice yet. Mm-hmm. And then when they socialize later in life, they might or when they get certain jobs that push them to certain challenges, these games will be behind their practice mentally.
Yeah. I was surprised that we had one guy who said that he learned, you know, not to judge people by how they look when they walk in the door. It was just really weird to hear that, the guy who said it in particular, because he's always like, I'm the best and you guys are awful. You know, this is just his attitude is, you know, he lets his attitude carry him through to win a lot. And he's like, but people come in and who I expect have no skill and they beat me. And just to have him say that in front of the group was, you know, a pretty amazing thing. And then there were other people who said, well, I've learned how to teach people, you know. And so we have had several mentors develop and you know, relationships have formed in the program. I mean, Brian, you were going to say something?
I mean, no. I mean, I really appreciate all the perspectives that the gamers gave to me. And even after the tournament, there were some games that I was trying to learn, and it was interesting to see the different sort of views or beliefs as it relates to, well, you should learn it on your own, or someone was trying to help me to learn it so it would be more fair. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it's about. It's about, you know, the experience of having those different perspectives and just having a low-stakes social environment where you can just relax and create friendships.
And on top of that, there's such an age range among all the kids there. You might see two older kids play a competitive game, and they might be a little more fierce with their smack talk. But then you have an older, like a teenager, playing against an elementary school age kid, and he knows to be a little gentler. He knows to treat the kid with a lot of accessibility.
Right, right. You guys are absolutely right. I think we've kind of pulled off of our topic of having Ron come to talk, but it is great that you guys can see the same stuff that I'm seeing, you know, working in the room from 10 minutes exposure or an hour exposure. And so basically my thought is, talk to the kids about video games in your library. Don't just put the games out there and say, go play. If video games have had any impact on your life, let them know about it. It had a great impact today, I think. Kids now know, wait a minute, we don't just have to sit through this experience. Some of them realize they'd learned something and they'd never even known it. Were there any other activities like this that you guys would suggest to be good for a game room if people have games in their things, or things you would like to have people talk to the kids about?
I want to see how these kids interact with analog games, and I want to know which analog games can actually hook them, if any.
We've had some, you know, luck with card games, but mostly with the younger kids.
I think that I would be interested in the use of emulators and bringing back some of these. I guess I'm kind of an old head, but bringing back some of these old games. And so the idea is that I think that if you bring in some of the older games, you're going to bring in some of the older gamers. And I think that if you bring in older gamers, then there's another chance for a learning opportunity, potentially.
So, well, we still have an old Xbox. It gets as much play as the 360s. I mean, even though the old Xbox is still a powerful machine.
We're in an era where the Xbox is an old
console. Exactly. I mean, a PlayStation is, I would say, is pushing the edge of, that's not an emulator, but, you know, if you could find an old PlayStation system and play a game like Ninja Gaiden or the original Super Mario Brothers, I mean, to have kids look at something like that would be, you know.
So bring older games into the library, whether you're talking about them or you're physically bringing them back in, just to get the kids thinking about where they are now and maybe where they're going in the future.
Yeah, because I think that if the kids are interested in the video games from a developer's perspective, I think showing them that history, that development of, well, you know, you can only throw rocks in that game, and then now you can do all sorts of things.
If you want to do that without bringing in old systems, check the Xbox Live Marketplace, check the Wii
Virtual Console.
And you're going to have access to some of the older games.
Yeah.
This is Donald.
I'm Ron.
I'm Tom.
And we'll let you go back to the Games and Libraries podcast. Thanks for listening.
This is Beth Galloway with a book review of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks, an epic quest for reality among role players, online gamers, and other dwellers of imaginary realms by Ethan Gilsdorf. When Ethan Gilsdorf was 17, he put down his 20-sided die in pursuit of girls, and by all appearances gave nary a backwards glance to his role-playing past as he moved forward to college and beyond. On the sly, however, he dabbled in geekdom like a tippler, hiding his bottle in a brown paper bag, a few quarters in an arcade here, browsing the new editions of the Dungeons & Dragons rulebooks there, even checking out collectible card games, like Magic: The Gathering. Then, in 2001, Fellowship of the Rings came out, and he fell off the wagon. He was fascinated with a Tolkien realm that Peter Jackson skillfully portrayed in his 3 award-winning epic films. Not only did this create some conflict with his significant other, it awakened an urge to reconnect with his geek past and investigate the appeal of immersive fantasy in his life and in the lives of others. Was he truly an adult, or stagnated forever in adolescence? To find out, Gilsdorf made a list of why fantasy appeals, and then set off on a classic hero's journey to discover the answer. While on this quest, Gilsdorf doesn't just interview and observe. He delves right in. His travels take him there and back again, from Oxford, England, to pay graveside respects, and then drink toasts to the professor with Tolkienites, to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to play Dungeons & Dragons again in the back room of a fantasy gaming store, and then south to Atlanta to participate in Forest of Doors for a live-action role-playing weekend. He spends some quality time with the band Harry and the Potters, descends into massively multiplayer online gaming culture, and lives to tell the tale, but emerges wanting more of the real thing. So off he goes to DragonCon, described in the book as, quote, a 4-day Halloween party embraced by every subculture, end quote. Finally, he journeys back across the pond on a New Zealand adventure to visit filming locations for the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Along the way, he wonders if the armed forces can't be likened to some sort of role play, ponders the staying power of geeks in love, and has his paradigm of what it truly means to be a geek constantly shifted. Gilsdorf is a solid writer and a good storyteller. No surprise there for someone with his role-playing background. He juxtaposes his personal story with strong journalistic reporting and infuses everything with a dose of integrity. A glossary of terms is appended, though many words are defined in context. The footnote on live-action role-playing, or LARPing, while extensive, is particularly excellent. Photos, many taken by the author, and excerpts from primary sources add to Gilsdorf's narrative. Says Gilsdorf about halfway through the book, quote, the appeal of LARPing was not the battles, but the collective storytelling, the camaraderie, end quote. Certainly, this can be applied to all types of gaming as well. It's about the story and the people, the gaming experience, not the gameplay. Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks serves as a guide to the colliding worlds of gaming and the fantasy genre, and it's an excellent primer for those who don't quite get it, but might be ready to make the leap to the experiential side of things. It will definitely have appeal to gamers who want to read about other aspects of fantasy and gaming subculture, especially those who want to see themselves represented fairly and insightfully in print. This book is recommended for public and academic library collections, and may even have some special appeal for teens who the world of gaming and fantasy has particular appeal for. Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks is available from the Lions Press in September 2009. It will retail for $24.95 in the U.S. in hardcover. For more information, or to see when Ethan will be doing an author visit near you, check out www.ethangilsdorf.com. That's www.ethangilsdorf.com. Don't worry, we'll put that link in the show notes for you.
Hi there, this is Scott Nicholson, and I have a board game review this month about Tales of the Arabian Nights. Tales of the Arabian Nights is actually a republished game. It came out back in the 1980s by West End Games, and it's been republished by Z-Man Games. It's been one of the Holy Grail games, meaning games that collectors pursue and try to get and pay hundreds of dollars for when they can find it. Tales of the Arabian Nights is a storytelling game. If you think back to Choose Your Own Adventure books, if you remember those, that's what Tales of the Arabian Nights is, but in a board game form. If you are looking for a board game with direct connections to literacy, you'd be hard-pressed to find one that's better than Tales of the Arabian Nights. Now, the game is about having adventures. You are one of the characters from the Arabian Nights moving around on a board, and you move to a space, draw a card, and many of the cards will have characters you'll meet, like an Ifrit, or a prince, or a vizier. You then look inside a book. Another player will read this book to you and read a story. And they'll tell you, well, you come up to a cave, and the Ifrit is outside of the cave and addresses you and says, would you help me with my brother? My brother is trapped within the cave. What do you do? And then the player has to make a choice, and based upon the choice, they move to a different paragraph in this book of tales and tell them what happened. And they may help them escape. They may get trapped inside. Who knows what will happen to you? Your characters have skills, and you have skills something like stealth and stealing, or weapon use, or piety, and many times in the game, if you have a certain skill, it'll help you accomplish a challenge. So the decision-making is based upon playing your character, saying, well, my character has piety, so maybe I should pray in this situation. The goal of the game, other than to have fun telling stories, is for a player to reach a certain number of destiny points and story points. As you go through adventures, you're going to be rewarded story points and destiny points and other sorts of rewards. At the start of the game, you set your own goals, and when you've accomplished your goals, you head back to Baghdad, and then you win the game. Hooray! Now, the game does have a few semi-adult themes. I would say it's a rated PG game. The other quandary with the game is the time it takes to play. It takes about half an hour per person that's playing the game. It can play up to six, but that would be a very long experience. And I would suggest, if you have a lot of people that want to play, put people into teams. It works fine as a team game, where the team decides what's going to happen. So rather than play with eight people, I would say play it in four teams of two, and it'll be a much better experience. The game mechanics are a little complex. They'll take a little time to read the instructions and understand how it goes. But it's a game where the players are reading to each other, where they are telling stories, a very narrative game experience. And so I'm excited that this game has come out. Now, where to get it? If you look for your friendly local game store, you should be able to find it there. If you don't have a friendly local game store, then you can go to Funnigan Games at funnigan.com. Funnigan actually has two things that are very friendly to libraries. First, they take purchase orders. And second, they have a monthly game grant for libraries, where they give $100 worth of games every month to a library. I've been really happy with Funnigan. They're very supportive of gaming and libraries. And so if you go to the show notes, you will find the links to Funnigan and where you can buy this game. So that's it for this month. That's Tales of the Arabian Nights, a clever storytelling game that I'm glad to see is back in print.
Games should be games first and narrative devices second, but when narrative works in a game, it truly is a magical thing. Passage is one such game where the developer isn't trying to make a glorified interactive film, but an honest-to-goodness game with a strong narrative element. Allowing the gamer to define their own objectives, such as seeking riches, exploring their environment, finding companionship, or a mix of all three, allows them to craft their own story. Contrast is the games such as Half-Life or BioShock, which are highly praised for their brilliant story, but are also linear and rigid in structure. Well-designed and challenging, but linear and rigid nonetheless. The fact that this game is also limited to 5-minute sessions, and that the game is complete after each session, gives a sense of solidity to the narrative created by the gamer. Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion is a fantasy RPG with a sandbox environment that allows for multiple game saves and takes place in a sprawling environment. Allowing the gamer to make multiple saves certainly helps in accomplishing game objectives and exploring this environment, but it doesn't ask the gamer to make a commitment to the repercussions of their actions. Whereas in Passage, there is no way to turn back the clock, no way to change your mind and override an action you had taken previously. Finally, I find it intriguing that there is no concept of win or loss, success or failure in Passage. There is an in-game condition, the time limit runs out, but there is no win-game condition. The result of this is the gamer having to examine how they feel after they finish the game. Did they feel they used their time wisely? Did they accomplish what they'd set out to do? Is there more they wish they could have done? Keep in mind that this game is meant to be an expression of life and death. Fit these equations into the context of the game, and it becomes pretty deep stuff. This level of introspection is rare for video games, and most games that set out to accomplish it come off as glorified interactive films. They don't feel like games. This really is a geniusly designed game, however, and I highly recommend Gravitation, another game by Jason Roer that I find even more emotionally involved. It actually made me cry a little bit.
If you find Brandon's discussion of Passage at all intriguing, then we invite you to play along with us. Passage is a free game that you can download and install on several platforms. It only takes about 5 minutes to play, but you can play it over and over and make different choices each time. It's a statement about life and our explorations through it. It's not designed as a game to be fun, but rather to think about how games are art. To get Passage, go to http://hcsoftware.sourceforge.net/passage. We'll put that link in the show notes for you. After you've played Passage at least once, read the author's comments about the game. Go back to the Passage website and look for the link. As a new activity of the Games and Gaming Member Initiative Group, we're starting a Game of the Month Club, and Passage is our game for August 2009. Like a book club, your goal will be to play a game and then join us online to talk about the game and different ways it could be incorporated into libraries. Our hope is to explore games and help you expand your own gaming horizons. We'll be covering all sorts of games over time, so even if you're a fan of just one type of game, this will be a way to explore some highlights or other game types. The main space for the club is going to be the discussion forum on ALA Connect at connect.ala.org/forum/11567. So check out Passage and then go to the forum to tell us about your experience and your ideas for how the game can be used in libraries.
Hi, it's Eli. How you doing? And today we're going to talk about a game jam. What is a game jam? Well, a game jam in its purest form is a 48-hour nonstop game programming contest. And they're very popular in like computer science departments at colleges and especially universities that have game development programs. It's a great thing to do to kind of have everyone focus for 48 hours nonstop on making a game from start to finish, usually very simple games. And often in a game jam, the participants in the game jam are given a set of assets, images and sounds and things to make the game out of. And sometimes they're even given a game engine with which to build it. So the task is you have a number of different teams and to see which team can make the very best game with the available assets. Now, I just got back from SIGGRAPH. SIGGRAPH is the graphics industry's trade show, for lack of a better way of describing it, but it also has a lot of art and academic papers and all kinds of crazy things. It's a very unique event. And for the first year, games were involved at SIGGRAPH, and this was part of the reason that I was there, and there was a game jam. I was fortunate to be able to help out with the production of the event just a little bit and do some fun challenges for the game jam participants to keep them awake during the long hours. So throughout it, I was like, boy, this would be a really pretty cool event for a library to do. I think part of the big deal here is that this is a content creation event, and I think we need to recognize that content creation is a big part of the future of libraries as opposed to warehousing established content that you'll be able to get anywhere. So when you look at what the challenges are of doing a game jam at a library, first of all, there are very few public libraries or school libraries that are open 48 hours in a row. Now, this might often be something that would happen at a university library, but generally on a university campus, there's other places that are better suited for a game jam to happen. However, a game jam doesn't have to be that way. And of course, a lot of libraries do lock-ins and things like that. So it's not unheard of to have an all-night event, although it is probably pretty unheard of to have two all-night events back-to-back right in a row with the same smelly people engaged in them the whole time. But, you know, a game jam doesn't necessarily have to be 48 hours in a row. It can be two 12-hour days. It could be just 24 hours. It could be, you know, a number of different ways of putting it together that I think are surmountable. What's kind of a bigger challenge for a library if they wanted to do this sort of a game development contest would be having enough technology for the participants to join in. And usually in a game jam, you want to provide the participants with the hardware and software that they'll need so that you can be sure that one of them isn't bringing in better hardware or our software and having an unfair advantage over the other competitors. So it's a great thing if you have some sort of a tech, a computer training lab or something like that, because there's a lot of free tools out there that you can use to create some pretty good games, and many of them are very well suited to a game jam. That said, you know, these computers need to not be behind the curve is a fair way of saying it, and often you might need some different bandwidth constraints, so there are some tech challenges associated with producing an event like this at a library. Also, you may not have your hooks into the community where there are game programmers who you can get in to help produce the event or to be participants in the event, and it's really dependent on how well you are in your community. But one of the coolest things about a game jam is for a library is I think it really offers a lot of unique opportunities for a library. You can do an unofficial game jam on your terms. You know, you can solve some of these problems, like I said, by having maybe two 12-hour days or something like that, that fits a little bit better with the library schedule. And you can use easier tools than the necessarily hardcore game jams that happen on university campus do. But the big thing is when you talk about that, you know, do we have the programmers in our community? This is a way to build that community, to get beginning programmers and give them a really cool project to sink their teeth into and have these geeks that are in your community that are engaged in this stuff or that want to be engaged in this stuff and give them a forum and a place to participate in this and have that be at the library. There's just there's a lot of potential there. And I think that game development is such an exciting thing for a number of young people across all sorts of different levels of interest that there's a really unique opportunity to get all kinds of different people, kids, teens, adults in the door and have them participate in a really cool, fun event that isn't just about beating each other up in Super Smash Brothers all over again. Not that there's anything wrong with that. So one thing that is kind of big about this is that there is this event called the Global Game Jam, which happened for the first time last January, and they're planning another one January 29th through 31st, 2010. And this is an opportunity where they're trying to get lots of different places all around the world to have the same sort of game jam at the same time with the same tools and the same assets. And then they have this awesome database of all the games that were made in this game jam and they get voted on. They decide which ones are the best ones. And it's a really cool way of seeing how many different types of creativity can be expressed with the same starting initial conditions. So that's one thing. It's hard to envision a lot of libraries being able to get involved in that directly, but if nothing else, you can have some events that are kind of ancillary to it or are tied into the game jam or building interest for other local game jam, or you can partner with your campus library or partner with other. A lot of times these are at sort of tech incubator places because they have the hardware and software. Sometimes they're actually at game developers. So if you have any nascent game developers in your town or established game developers in your town, it might be something that'd be great for you to partner with because it would get some geeks there or some kids or some other sorts of participants into their places to find out more about it. Another event that's very similar to the Global Game Jam is something called Scratch Day. Scratch is a really cool graphical game creation system developed at the MIT Media Lab. And Scratch is really cool. They've done some really great stuff with the Hennepin County Library. And it's a very fun and easy to use tool. And they have a Scratch Day where they try to get lots of different people to do Scratch events and try to create Scratch games all on the same day. Very similar to Game Jam, but I think much more approachable for a wider range of users. Now, they haven't scheduled Scratch Day for 2010 yet, but you might want to keep your eyes open for that. Now, there's a number of different tools that can get used when you're doing a game jam. Scratch is, of course, one of them. A lot of times people use Panda 3D, which is a really kind of approachable Python-based 3D authoring environment, but that's really for hardcore programmers. But there's a number of other tools out there that you can use to do a game jam at a library that are will open it up to a wider range of skill levels. One is Alice. Alice is a sort of a competitor to Scratch, but it actually there's more under the hood, and you need to know a little bit more about programming. Alice.org is that specific product, but they've got a lot. It's developed by Carnegie Mellon, and it's kind of like their answer to Scratch, but there's a lot of different knowledge, again, for that. A better example is a tool called Greenfoot, which is a Java-based game authoring system, but it's a lot more like Scratch in terms of dragging and dropping things and putting things together, and it's very approachable, and it kind of gives you, similar to Scratch, a good introduction to the concepts of programming without having to worry about syntax quite as much. But what's really great about Greenfoot is there's a website built around Greenfoot that allows you to see curriculum for doing, in the case of this website, actually Greenfoot-based summer camps. And the name of the site is p4games.org, and the P4 stands for Pixels, Programming, Play, and Pedagogy. And it's a pretty interesting site, and there's a lot of good information there. If nothing else, it'll really let you see What are some of the things you need to think about if you're going to do any sort of a game development curriculum? I know there are some vendors out there on the scene that are offering, ready-made game development programs. But part of the challenge with some of those is that the games you can make with some of those tools really stink. And for kids who are interested in making games, it's fun to make a game, but it's more fun to make a game that doesn't look like everyone else's game and isn't kind of crappy right out of the box. Another excellent one is GameStar Mechanic. GameStar Mechanic is a super cool project developed by GameLab, and it is just a really unique level design and sort of very beginning scripting tool that allows you to make some really cool games. And one of the most fun things about GameStar Mechanic is that you gain assets by kind of playing through these GameStar games, and it's like an RPG, and you get the different assets, and that allows you to make better games. You could even do sort of game development mini programs based around some of the retail software that allow you to create your own levels, like Little Big Planet or Boomblocks. Boomblocks has a really great level editing mode, and a Boomblocks level creation contest would be a really cool event. You give the kids some time to try to make their levels, and then you let everybody play the levels, have them judge them on a different day, something like that. That can be a lot of fun, and the nice thing about it is you really don't have to know much about it going into it. So there's a number of different authoring tools out there, but I think it's a important thing as you're expanding your gaming audience to think not just about how can we consume the game content together, but how can we create game content together, because that's really going to be one of the critical transitions for libraries to make in the 21st century, is the transition from a consumptive model to a creative model, because frankly, our place in the content consumption chain is unlikely to survive much longer, because we're going to be cut out of the equation. So that's your dire prediction for today. Hope you've enjoyed this. Be sure to check out some of these resources online. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
One add-on I would like to make on Eli's excellent contribution. I fully agree that we need to be doing more creation programs in libraries with games. One idea is to do a junkyard games program. Now, the way this works is you give everyone the same box of stuff. The assets in this case are physical assets, things that you could use to make a board game, for example, dice and movers and poster board and markers. You then give everyone a couple hours to make a game, and then you play each other's games. It's a great team activity. You could do the same thing and actually send the boxes of stuff home with people, and then a month later you have a program where families bring the games they designed using the same box of stuff. And so game design does not just have to be electronic game design. You can do really cool stuff with analog game design as well. That brings us to the end of this month's podcast. We'd like to thank you for joining us. If you want to hear more episodes, head to gamesandlibraries.org. We'd like to thank the Verizon Foundation and thinkfinity.org for their continued support of the Games and Libraries podcast. Thanks a lot, and I'll talk to you next month. Bye-bye.